after having received support from the United States in usurping the presidency and consolidating its dictatorship, Brazil's military decided to try its hand at foreign interference, working against democracies around Latin America. The idea was that working outside its own borders would help weaken the left on the continent and expand the scope of Brazil's repressive powers. Capital cities around the region that once served as refuge for Brazilian political exiles would soon become new dictatorship outposts to monitor and even exterminate opponents.
No parece conciliarse esta visión de las posibilidades de evolución pacífica de nuestro país con la violencia desatada por grupos antisociales que actúan desde una oscuridad, por cierto, indigna de un país que se ha enorgullecido siempre de ofrecer la plenitud de su libertad para dividir y dividir.
Documents from the United States indicate that the Brazilian military dictatorship worked to rig the 1971 elections in neighboring Uruguay, even coming up with a plan for military invasion, were the left to have won at the polls. 2 years later, an agreement between the elected president and the armed forces put Uruguay under military rule. In that same year of 1973, the Brazilian military lent its know-how and logistical and diplomatic support to the violent military coup in Chile. At the time, Uruguay and Chile had been the homes of the region's most consolidated democracies. A few years later, another military coup in Argentina began the bloodiest dictatorship in South American contemporary history. Well, if the Brazilian dictatorship was already able to persecute opponents abroad with the lights on, imagine what it was able to do in the 1970s with the lights turned off in every corner of the region. Saying that, it also had to learn how to walk in the dark and collaborate with other authoritarian regimes. My name is Isabella Cruz, and this is the third episode of our special podcast mini-series Love It or Live It, the Brazilian military dictatorship from within to abroad.
Warm and friendly relations with the people of Brazil.
To a sede do governo.
Contem com as Forças Armadas pela democracia e pela liberdade.
Authoritarianism was widespread in South America. Bolivia had been living under military rule since 1964, just months after the coup in Brazil. Peru had been a dictatorship since 1968, and Paraguay had been controlled by General Alfredo Stroessner since a coup in the 1950s. The United States National Security Doctrine, which established leftists as internal enemies, provided a common denominator in the Southern Cone, as did the political manipulation of moral religious conservatism.
There's been a great deal of historical work dealing with not only the security and political and anti-communist logic of Southern Cone military dictatorships, but also their social logic, their reactionary logic. The work of historian Ben Cowan, for example, deals in large part with the way that the Brazilian military dictatorship articulated a distinctly conservative, moralistic view when it came to things like gendered relations and gender roles. And so I think increasingly with the new wave of historical scholarship is placing that dynamic at the center of these regimes. We cannot understand these dictatorships, Chile and Argentina and Brazil, without reference to these heteronormative, deeply paternalistic and gendered expectations imposed through violence across the region.
The voice you've just heard belongs to André Pagliarini, who's a history professor at Hampden-Sydney College in the United States, specializing in Latin America. He's also a columnist for the Brazilian Report and will be taking part throughout this episode. The discourse in defense of Western and Christian values gave a heroic veneer to the institutionalized violence and to the delinquency of public power. Within this reactionary wave across South America, it was the Chilean dictator General Augusto Pinochet who proposed a joint mechanism of repression, the infamous Condor Plan, at a time when Brazil was already announcing a slow, gradual, and safe political reopening. Pinochet came to power through a violent coup on September 11, 1973. The bombing of the Palacio de la Moneda overthrew the socialist president Salvador Allende, who had been democratically elected on a platform of profound but peaceful reform. In overthrowing their government, Chile's coup plotters used the Brazilian dictatorship playbook as an example to follow. Indeed, the Brazilian regime was an early supporter of the Chilean military after its coup, as the country's armed forces didn't have quite the same experience in coups as their counterparts in Brazil or Argentina.
In very broad terms, we can speak of a tradition of military involvement in Latin American affairs after independence. With some exceptions, Chile and Uruguay did not have as much of a tradition of military involvement. And that changes in the Cold War, most notably Chile, which had a long tradition of really being proud of the fact that it had a mostly consolidated democracy. It had not had the tradition of the caudillos of other parts of the continent. And it's impossible, I think, to extract that context of the Cold War.
In this Cold War context, the Brazilian dictatorship worked together with Chilean conspirators from the armed forces to far-right paramilitary groups and led a regional campaign to isolate Allende. This entire process was researched in depth by Roberto Simon in the book Brazil Against Democracy, The Dictatorship, The Coup in Chile, and the Cold War in South America, published by Companhia das Letras in 2021. A journalist and international analyst with a master's degree in public policy from Harvard University in the United States, Simone will also participate in this podcast.
In 1970, when Salvador Allende was elected president, Santiago was really the capital of Brazil's exile community, right? We had thousands and thousands of Brazilians not only living in Santiago, but also organizing, participating in the local political and cultural life and so on. And then Chile elects a truly socialist president, bent on doing a revolution through peaceful means, but a revolution in Chile.
Consecuentes con lo que ha sido nuestra historia y tradición, estamos realizando esta transformación revolucionaria, profundizando el régimen democrático, respetando el pluralismo de nuestra organización política dentro del orden legal y con los instrumentos jurídicos que el país se ha dado.
And all of a sudden, this country that had always been a key partner of Brazil starts to be seen by the Brazilian dictatorship as an existential threat, existential to the 1964, or the regime that was started in 1964. The notion was that Chile was about to become the Cuba of the Pacific, namely a country to where thousands of Brazilian guerrilla and guerrilla from other places would go to train and then wage or try to do a revolution in Brazil and so on and so forth. So if you look at what the National Security Council of Brazil was discussing at the time, they were referring to Chile as a bridgehead of the international communist movement targeting Brazil specifically. So Brazil decides to act, and Chile becomes really this threat to Brazilian territory and the Brazilian regime installed in 1964.
Many of these perceptions were exaggerated, says Pagliarini.
Most of the documentation would indicate that the forces of repression and policing were more coordinated and organized than the opposition in most Latin American countries for obvious reasons. The forces of opposition were disorganized largely, they were disrupted, they faced heavy state repression, whereas the forces of the state, of the dictatorial regimes, counted on support from the United States, logistical and financial support from local business communities. There was just much more space for them to organize transnationally against opposition forces. The most emblematic example of this, of course, is Operation Condor, which was a transnational effort of various military regimes to hunt down dissidents across borders and really put them down in violent, brutal ways. And so there was nothing at that scale analogous amongst the opposition who might be able to share some ideas clandestinely and sneak information out of each country. The Catholic Church plays an important role in organizing some of these channels, but the scale and the organization of the repressive apparatus is really operating at another level throughout the Cold War in the region.
Even so, an important network of Brazilian exiles was establishing itself in Chile. They managed to organize themselves into associations, and many continued to denounce the abuses that occurred in Brazil. Seeing the Chilean military become increasingly involved in that country's politics, the Brazilian government of General Emilio Medici, in line with large business groups in both countries, set to work on a plan to topple Allende and put an ally at the head of the Chilean government. The persecution of Brazilian exiles in Chile was already happening at this point, but it was about to become easier.
Brazil had been operating, or the Brazilian repression had been operating internationally since 1964. First in Uruguay, then in Chile, really surveilling the Brazilian exile community in Santiago and in other cities, and also in places like Buenos Aires. So even before the 1973 coup against Allende, we had cases of Brazilians that were living in Chile and traveled to Argentina, were kidnapped in Argentina, and then reappeared in torture chambers in Brazil, right, resurfaced in Brazil. After the coup, this happened to a major that had joined the opposition in Brazil, and he was kidnapped in the streets of Buenos Aires and resurfaced in the Doi Codi of Rio de Janeiro.
Habla el Teniente General Don Jorge Rafael Videla.
Al pueblo de la Nación Argentina. El país transita por una de las etapas más difíciles de su historia. Colocado al borde de la disgregación, la intervención de las Fuerzas Armadas ha constituido la única alternativa posible frente al deterioro provocado por el desgobierno, la corrupción y la complacencia.
With the military coup against Isabelita Perón, Brazil-Argentina repression also reached another level. There is evidence of secret agreements to kill or kidnap people on the border between the two countries, in addition to other joint operations. During the 7 years of this last military dictatorship in Argentina, led by General Jorge Videla, more than 10,000 people were disappeared. Some estimates speak of up to 30,000 people. Returning to Chile, Brazil was the first country to recognize the new military government. A month after the coup, the Brazilian dictatorship already sent intelligence officers to work with interrogators inside the National Stadium in Santiago, which had been converted into a giant detention and torture center. Sales by the Brazilian military industry to the Chilean dictatorship also soared, with Brazil offering loans with very friendly terms to the Pinochet regime. Indeed, dozens of agents of Chile's secret police were trained in Brazil. After the Chilean dictatorship fell, several of them would be convicted of the murders, torture, and kidnappings they carried out. Shortly after Pinochet's rise, Medici's terms as president in Brazil came to an end. he would be succeeded by General Ernesto Geisel. Crucially, Geisel came from the wing of the military that intended to hand Brazil back to civilian control. As such, his approach to Pinochet in Chile had to be very well calculated, especially considering the widespread brutality of that regime.
Geisel was elected 6 months after the coup in Chile. So he became president in March 1974, and he came to power determined to impose unilaterally, if you will, this controlled transition that would include basically the generals going back to the barracks and this long and very controlled transition towards a civilian government. And in 1974, early 1974, Pinochet, on the other hand, was really the incarnation of, you know, all the discussions about human rights violations in the Southern Cone, right? The news coming out of Chile about torture, about executions, made Pinochet really an international pariah. Pinochet says that he wants to go to Geisel's inauguration in March 1974. Geisel and his team explicitly tell the Chilean ambassador that that was a really bad idea. But Pinochet really needed to get out of the country, try to fight this international isolation, and he decides to go to Brazil anyway. And this initiates a period in which Brazil doesn't want, or Geisel himself doesn't want to, you know, associate himself to Pinochet, but at the same time, Brazil is committed to the quote-unquote success of the Chilean military regime. Right, a regime that would be able to control the economic and security situation in Chile would not be targeted by sanctions or any type of boycotts due to human rights violations, given that Brazil also faces grave accusations of human rights violations. So publicly, you know, Geisel would keep a distance, but at the same time, you know, diplomatically and in terms of intelligence and repression, Brazil would continue to cooperate closely with the Chileans.
In the diplomatic arena, Geisel's political calculations involved guaranteeing Brazil the position of regional power, standing out from its neighbors. They also involved the country's relationship with the United States, which under the presidency of Democrat Jimmy Carter began to exert great pressure against the systematic violations of human rights carried out by South American governments.
Brazil was ready to collaborate with other Southern Cone dictatorship, exchanging information, conducting joint operations. But at the same time, Brazil did not want to see a coalition or an axis of anti-communist regimes operating against, for example, the United States after the election of Jimmy Carter, when it becomes clear that human rights was at the center of U.S. foreign policy, or would be at the center of U.S. foreign policy. In one moment, the Argentines, the Chilean, the Uruguayans, they come together and invite Brazil to build a joint front to oppose Jimmy Carter's pressures vis-a-vis the human rights situation in South America. And Brazil sabotages the entire operation and in fact leaks information to the United States, to the Carter administration, because also Brazil thought that the situation, the Brazilian situation in terms of human rights and political openness was very different from what the Chileans, the Uruguayans and the Argentines were going through, right? And it would be detrimental to Brazil to be put together kind of in the same pack as these other smaller countries, right? Brazil had also the notion it was the regional power, right? And so it was at a different status than neighboring countries. And the Carter administration was tough on Brazil, on human rights and the nuclear program. But also Brazil understood that the United States did not have the legitimacy, or any country for that matter, to question the human rights situation in South American countries.
Disagreements in the nuclear field, a hot topic of the Cold War, reached the Southern Cone and also opposed Brazil and Argentina. In other words, even though the dictatorships shared a series of affinities, national interests could still be conflicting, and they spoke louder. André Pagliarini puts it like this.
Especially in the early period of military rule, when these dictatorships have come into power in the 1960s and early 1970s, these military regimes in the Southern Cone, by and large, saw themselves as part of a shared struggle, very much aligned with the United States against communism, against the Soviet Union, against the infiltration of dissidents across the region. Over time, there arise differences of opinion. Maybe the most emblematic case would be between Brazil and Argentina in the 1980s regarding nuclear weapons. There was something of a mini arms race between these two neighboring countries, both very large economies, both very brutal dictatorships in the 1970s into the early 1980s that kept secrets from each other, but ultimately were able to come to the table regarding the issue of nuclear power and nuclear weapons to diffuse potential conflicts. But that case of nuclear tensions between Argentina and Brazil exemplify the fact that these countries were not always on the same page. They each shared a regional agenda, anti-communist agenda, but also harboring distinct national agendas as well that were not always compatible.
At the end of 1975, Pinochet decided to take a further step toward fully integrating the repressive apparatus of South American dictatorships, and called a meeting to propose a fixed structure of cooperation. The result of this meeting was the Condor Plan, which provided for centralized data collected by each dictatorship government, exchanges of representatives, periodic meetings, and propaganda actions. Brazilian representatives attended the first meeting, but only agreed to officially join the initiatives months later. Brazil even provided equipment so that the group's communications could be encrypted, probably without success against the United States. But as Simon's research shows, Geisel's dictatorship soon assessed that Chile, Uruguay, and Argentina, now under Videla, intended to take the Condor Plan too far, with plans for assassinations in Paris and Lisbon. Let's see what he says.
And the Argentines and the Uruguayans started with the idea of Condor operation, basically centralizing everything and operating this multinational, if you will, of repression. Brazil had really, second thoughts about it. At first, Brazil, in the first meeting, Brazil refuses to directly participate. In the second meeting, Brazil agrees and tries to kind of take over the entire operation, being kind of the sponsor and providing communications, technology, etc. But as a mean to exchange information, when it becomes clear that the Chileans were really looking, also the Argentinians and the Uruguayans were really looking to hunt their opponents, not only in South America, but also in places like Europe or even the United States.
The United States was also unsatisfied with the possibility of joint action by South Americans in Europe, NATO's sphere of influence. Even so, Augusto Pinochet's government managed to carry out an assassination in Washington. From 1977 onwards, Brazil stopped participating in meetings of the Condor Plan. This contributed to undermining the more ambitious aspirations of the other members. However, this does not mean that the Brazilian dictatorship backed away from international repression. It's just that the regime preferred bilateral collaboration in a way that was a bit more discreet. Partnering with authoritarian neighbors, as Simon says, was a difficult balance.
Brazil understood that for the United States to attack Pinochet for human rights violation was dangerous because it could set a precedent that could then be used against Brazil, right? If you talk about torturing Chile and Argentina and Uruguay, you may talk as well about torture in Brazil. So in that sense, Brazil partner with others and defended Chile and others in international fora like the UN or the OAS. But at the same time, it was a very delicate balance. Brazil was not willing to build a coalition to vocally denounce Jimmy Carter's human rights campaign in the region. They thought it would be much better just to let Itamaraty do the work through back channels and quiet diplomacy.
O presidente eleito João Batista de Figueiredo e o vice Aureliano Chaves, escoltados pelo 1º Regimento de Cavalaria, são saudados por populares e jovens estudantes de todos os recantos do Brasil na manhã de 15 de março de 1979, dia de sua posse em Brasília.
In Brazil, Geisel's successor, General João Figueiredo, continued with the dictatorship's slow political reopening process. The end of Brazil's economic miracle and reports of the regime's violence only served to ramp up pressure for a return to democracy. In the 1980s, often called the lost decade in Brazil, a high degree of foreign debt stood in the way of new investment. Social inequality soared and inflation was out of control. In this moment and throughout the entire dictatorship, art played a fundamental role in social mobilization against authoritarianism. Under censorship and threats, artists had to redouble their courage to contest and challenge power and its values in cinema, theater, literature, and in many other fields.
Mas não diga nada que me viu chorando e bruxa pesada diz que eu vou levando.
With its broad reach, music was fundamental. The Brazilian public latched on to certain songs from the period as anthems of resistance. This was also the case in other dictatorships in the region. So, for you to check out some of the musical wonders that were produced during such a dark period, we've prepared a special playlist with songs that define the resistance against the dictatorships in Brazil and other countries mentioned in this episode. The link to the playlist will be in this episode's show notes. I hope you like it. Back to the slow rhythm of institutional politics, the return to democracy in Brazil was gradual, starting with the reintroduction of a multi-party system and direct elections for state governors. The regime thought that direct elections for president would be too much at first, with the first civilian president after the dictatorship being elected by lawmakers. Throughout this process, not everyone in the military was happy with the idea of returning to democracy and handing back power. And some of these movements carried out a series of attacks and bombings to try to prove that a political opening would be chaotic. They feared that once they were no longer in power, they would be held accountable for their crimes during the dictatorship. But at least in Brazil, there was no reason for them to fear facing justice. Before leaving power, the generals first approved an amnesty law, which, in addition to freeing political prisoners, also freed the military itself from liability for the crimes perpetrated throughout the public sector. The consequences of this will be the guiding thread of episode 4, the last of this mini-series. This podcast series is written by me, Isabela Cruz, and produced by André Chiavassa. The script was edited by Ewan Marshall. We'd also like to thank André Pagliarini and Roberto Simon for their participation. As always, we ask you to give us a 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. It takes only a second, and it will help us reach a broader audience. Or better yet, sign up for the Brazilian Report, the journalistic engine behind this podcast. Thanks for being here with us. Don't miss the final episode in 2 weeks' time. Until then, enjoy our special playlist of music from across South America during this difficult time for democracy.